Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 2 Clarifying Lecture. I'll start off with the announcements, get to the inner teaching, quick note about the ABA sets, and then get to your questions. So I only have really one announcement this week, and that's about the behaviors bio. Make sure that you are using the template and that everything goes in that same template. Each of the assignments is going to build on each other. So first you identify the author, now you're going to do the bibliography to make sure that you have the right types of articles. You'll use that first thing about academic honesty to write that annotated bibliography, then you'll write your paper, then you do video, then you do peer review, and then your final products. So everything should be in one contiguous document because it builds upon each other. Make sure also that you set editing access to on. That has been an issue. It's going to delay you getting stuff back. So it needs to be in Google, needs to be in that template. Edit access needs to be set to on. So those things are going to get your stuff back more quickly to you. All right, so let's talk about your inner teach. I did check this week for collaboration. Most of you are doing exactly what you need to do. Be careful of the use of the word I in your inner teach because your responses should be we's. They should not be I's. Didn't see a lot of divide and conquer. That was nice. I saw more discussion, which is good. That's what I'm looking for. I know the book uses the word analyst to talk about behavior analysts. In some places, they're going to be a little fast and loose with the terms. And so I'm a little bit more strict with this because I'm of the notion and also getting feedback from former students, the stricter we are with the terms, the easier the exam is, the big ABA exam. So I want to make sure that we're using proper terms. Usually analyst is reserved for Freudian analysis. So, you know, if you've heard psychoanalysis, you know, psychoanalyst, but we are behavior analysts, so we use the whole term. We don't use behavioral analyst, we use behavior analyst because behavior analyst, we analyze behavior, we don't analyze behaviorally. All right, some of your ideas of positive and negative reinforcement are really good. Just a reminder that we are a natural science, so positive means to add, negative means to subtract. It doesn't mean good or bad. I like the one about late fees being positive punishment. That was awesome. And just remember that we cannot gain or lose reinforcement. So sometimes I'll hear people say earn reinforcement. That's not how this works. And that's when you're starting to look at it kind of like a procedure. Reinforcement is the relationship between a behavior and some stimulus. So if that stimulus that's presented after that behavior occurs in the environment, whether it's presented by another human or just naturally in the environment or by a non-human species, is going to increase the probability of that behavior occurring in the future. So it's a relationship between a specific response and a specific reinforcer. Why is this important? Well, first of all, it's important because we don't reinforce people. Why is that important? Because we don't change people. We change specific behaviors, very specific behaviors. And so we're not out to change people as a whole. Yeah, we can't do that. That's not physically possible. We're out to change specific responses. And we really don't have control over the entire environment. So, we're only looking at small pieces of behavior at a time, and really only parts of what influences that behavior. The vending machine, a lot of you got really good responses there. Another terminology thing is remember that reinforcement can't motivate. Motivating operations are antecedents that make reinforcers stronger or weaker. So a motivating operation cannot be a consequence. Okay. Reinforcer, a stimulus is either a reinforcer or there's a motivating operation in effect. So reinforcement does not motivate. Okay. This was a question that kind of came up because people were like, well, how do I know if it's punishment? How do I know if it's negative reinforcement? So punishment and negative reinforcement often work in the inverse of each other. So when a behavior is punished, the next opportunity to respond, something else takes its place that is hopefully negatively reinforced. So usually if something is presented or taken away and behavior decreases, that's punishment. If an alternative behavior then occurs, it's like reset, we're starting a new thing. So alternative behavior occurs, that behavior is then negatively reinforced. So if you think about it kind of like a step up type of thing. Again, remember you can't reinforce or punish people. You can only reinforce and punish responses, specific responses. And that positive does not mean good. Remember, we're in natural science. So positive means to add, negative means to subtract. And this is a common error that I see where people talk about consequences and they're referring to punishment. This is the way the rest of the world talks about it. Consequences can be reinforcing, they can be punishing. But to say, oh, well, there's rewards and consequences, this is not how behavior analysis works. First of all, reward is something different than reinforcement. Consequences are anything that comes after a response that affects its probability. So consequences can be either reinforcing, where they go up, or punishing, where they go down. So that's important to know. For the potty training example, I want you to think about, now we're going to do ethics in 664, but I want you to really think about, you know, the context in which all these types of things occur. So while we talk about the three-term contingency as antecedent, response, consequence, that's great. Okay, so that's the, you know, basic unit, if you will, the atom. Okay, and so that's the atom. But as we know, atoms come together, they form elements, you know, then go into chains, and, you know, you remember chem. And then, you know, chem then influences bio, bio influences physics, all these types of things, and vice versa. So think about the three or four term contingency as an atom, okay? And that atoms very rarely float all by themselves in space. That there's all kinds of atoms always going on all over, you know, the environment. Same thing with behavior. There are all kinds of contingencies that typically influence behavior, not just the three-term contingency that we typically look at. So what are some contingencies that might affect potty training? Well, some of you said, you know, is this within reach or without reach? Okay, that's good. But I threw in the single mom and the grandparent on purpose, because I may have this wonderful intervention that the RBT or the BCBA can do with fidelity. But if there are all kinds of competing contingencies, it may be impossible for a parent or a grandparent to implement those things with fidelity. And that doesn't make them terrible parents or terrible grandparents. It means that there are competing contingencies that, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day. We only have two arms and two legs, most of us. You know, there's limits to how much we can do. And so we have to keep those in mind as well as we're putting together our programming. Also, I want you to try to get away from, if you can, from programming examples, from when I'm in RBT, or this is about kids, or when I'm in a classroom. While all of this does work within that stuff, and that's a good place to start if you're used to that type of environment, I want you to understand that what you're learning is a foundation for why all sentient beings do what they do. Okay, so if something moves and breathes and does things, the laws of behavior apply. The laws of behavior are applying to you watching or listening to this podcast. The laws of behavior apply to me sitting in my office on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock making this video and turning it into a podcast. The laws of behavior apply to when I get into my car and drive home. The laws of behavior apply to when I attend my spin class and, you know, when I do something as inane as, you know, change the resistance on the bike. These all come together. All of these laws of behavior come together to explain why we do what we do. Okay. Now to the ABA sets. I only have one thing to say, and that is keep up with them. They take up a lot of time. They are very labor intensive, and as some of you seem to have found out, they are very exacting. So, you know, extra space, extra misspelling, whatever, that's going to set you right back to the beginning. So you want to be detail oriented with them. You want to make sure that you have good spelling, and you want to make sure that you are setting aside a good amount of time for them, because they do take several hours to do. So please make sure that you're keeping up with those throughout the term. All right, questions. All right, so our first question is, I could not find the acronym FERG in Chapter 4. Could you review this acronym and how you would use it in writing a behavior goal? I think you mean FERB, FERB, like Phineas and Ferb. And what it means is functionally equivalent replacement behavior. So whenever you get rid of one behavior, you need to have something to take its place. It's not as critical to this course that you understand that. That's going to come in 623 when you take that. That's when we're going to start doing goal writing and things like that. So for right now, just know what it means, but you don't need to know too much about how to use it. Same thing with the three criteria on which the BACB mission statement is based. The study guides do come from study guides made from Behavior Analysis for Lasting Change on their website. So some questions will be helpful, others may not be as much. This is one of those. Under what circumstances could a behavior analyst, and I see you wrote behavioral, make sure you're saying behavior analyst, disclose confidential information about a client without their consent? Great question. Again, you'll get into this again in 621 and 623 when we talk about informed consent. But basically, it's any time that it's possible that someone might be breaking the law, or they say they're going to break the law. So, you know, somebody says that if you have reason to believe that it's credible that someone says, you know, I'm going to kill my wife, you have to report that. Confidentiality goes out the window. If you see abuse or neglect, you have to report that. Confidentiality goes out the window. If you are subpoenaed and all of your, you know, we'll talk a lot about professional writing, about being professional in the courses. Anything that you write that's part of a medical record, that can be subpoenaed. So you are working with legal documents, and those would have to be turned over based on the subpoena. So basically, it's usually when you suspect that there might be some illegal activity, or you have been contacted by law enforcement, are usually the times. There are some things for insurance too. There are times when you can disclose things to insurance without consent, but that's basically what you have to know for right now. Okay, this last one, contingencies of survival discussed by Skinner, example of the dead man test. There's three questions here. I'm going to get to them each piece by piece. So contingencies of survival as discussed by Skinner. And again, you're going to look at this more in more detail later on in your coursework. But basically, behavior of an organism evolves in the same way regular evolution evolves. So if you look at it, we evolve within ourselves and also then pass down our traits and they evolve. But basically what happens is that our species has survived because we've engaged in behaviors that promote those survival tactics, those survival tactics then get passed on to the next generation, and so on and so forth, until they kind of get encoded into our genetic code. For example, if a baby is born, you put a baby on mom's chest, the baby will route towards the breast. That is not something that needs to be taught or reinforced or anything like that. How did that start? Isn't that against behaviorism? It's actually not. So babies who fed survived, okay, back in the day, you know, centuries, centuries, and centuries ago. Babies who survived grew up, did other things for survival, and had more babies. And those babies who ate survived. And so on and so on and so on and so on until it became innate. So that's kind of how our repertoires work. So we do things, variation. Those things that are reinforced continue. Those that are not, don't. Okay? Reducing it down, but that's pretty much what it is. So we have variation. And our repertoire of things that we do normally is selected by reinforcement. So if you think of, you know, is it nature, is it nurture? Sometimes people go, oh, Skinner didn't believe in genetics. Not true. Okay, some things are innate, but they were passed down through generation to generation. The things in our repertoire are selected through reinforcement. Could you provide an example of the dead man's principle? Okay, sure. So, this is one that is from my childhood. So I was in California with my sister. My sister's much older than I am, in the 80s, and we stopped at a fruit stand and we got bunches of cherries and peaches and all kinds of stuff. And I couldn't stop eating the cherries. I was maybe about 9. And I'm eating cherries and cherries and cherries and cherries. And my sister turns around and, you know, she's worried about me, you know, getting sick. So she says, no more cherries. You can't eat any more cherries. She says, I turn around and you're eating a peach. Well, you know, you didn't tell me what to do. You told me what not to do. So anytime that we invoke the dead man's rule, in that we always want whatever we're saying we're doing to be active. So we don't say not paying attention. Or we don't say, you know, doesn't do anything, or isn't responding, or whatever it is, because those are things that the dead man can do. What is it that they're actually doing? So, for example, you know, let's take the, they're not participating. Well, what are they doing? They're laying on the floor, looking up and giggling. Okay? Laying on the floor, you know, that's something that might not pass the dead man's test. But looking up at the ceiling, yep. Giggling? Definitely. So we always want to talk about behavior in terms of action rather than inaction. Hopefully that helps. And what's the difference between something being motivating and being reinforcing? So motivation is more of a state than a thing. Okay, so you have stimuli in the environment, okay? Stimuli that come after the behavior that increase its frequency are reinforcing, okay? Because of that reinforcement, behavior happens again. Motivation comes as an antecedent. So if you think about the three-term contingency, you know, SD, response, reinforcer, and then you think of all of the environmental events that can make that either stronger or weaker. I like to think about it like a dimmer switch on a light bulb. Those things that make the contingency stronger or, you know, more bright are establishing operations, and those that make the contingency weaker are abolishing operations. So for example, if you've eaten a big meal and then someone says, you know, you have to man for a chocolate bar, the probability of you manning is much lower, even if chocolate is reinforcing, because you've eaten a big meal. That big meal is the motivating operation. Conversely, when I wake up in the morning, coffee, caffeine, is a very strong reinforcer for me to get out of bed. So, you know, at that point, the motivating operation of I just got out of bed, you know, haven't had coffee, it's really early, my dog got me up at 4:45, all those things are motivating operations to make that accessing coffee that much stronger. Now, if it's 6 in the evening, I've had coffee, I've had an energy drink, which I don't really drink, but I've had tea, and I've had a Dr. Zevia, which are really good, by the way. Now, you know, the idea of having caffeine is not nearly as reinforcing, right? So, that motivating operation has dimmed the power of that reinforcer, okay? So if you think about kind of motivating is, you know, is the reinforcer super powerful or not powerful? Reinforcing means, you know, is it something that will continue the response later on? Hopefully that helps. Thank you very much for watching. That's this week's clarifying lecture, and I'll talk to you soon.